Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. War in Ukraine continues to cause mayhem and destroy the lives of many, and it's everyone's responsibility to limit the global food, fuel and financial crisis that it has spawned, the UN's top rights official told the Human Rights Council on Monday in her last session as High Commissioner. Nearly 4 months since the Russian invasion, Michelle Bachelet used her keynote address to the Council to urge member states not to give up on the post-COVID-19 recovery plan, to recover better and avoid the kind of global financial meltdown seen in 2008. Failure to stick to what was agreed during the dark days of the pandemic, to ignore its lessons and above all not to put people first in this global recovery, threatened to leave people and economies even less able to resist new shocks than they are now, the UN rights chief insisted.
Eager to avoid the devastating consequences of the austerity that followed the 2008 financial crisis, the international community agreed to change course, building together transformative societies and towards greener economies that will be more resilient to crisis. We are now facing a vital test of that commitment, and we need to meet it.
Ms. Bachelet, who announced that she was stepping down as High Commissioner for Human Rights, highlighted the need for all countries to respect the climate commitments that they'd made in 2015 in Paris, and also the 2030 Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs, whose financing gap has now widened to some $4.3 trillion per year. A critical $195 million lifeline for rural families in Afghanistan has been pledged by the World Bank. It's been announced. Welcoming the development, the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, said that the funding would provide critical livelihood and life-saving assistance to the country's most vulnerable populations. The cash assistance will also help to boost food production and smallholder resilience, FAO said, warning that nearly 20 million people in Afghanistan are now unable to feed themselves every day. Dangerously high levels of acute food insecurity persist across Afghanistan because of a combination of the collapsing economy and continuing drought. Tasked with leading the response, UN agency FAO will focus on wheat production to support about 2.1 million people in coming planting seasons and on supporting the nutritional needs of children, people with disabilities or chronic illness, and households headed by women. This assistance includes providing seeds and basic tools for gardening and technical training on improved nutrition and climate-smart production practices. Almost 1 million people will benefit from this support, particularly rural women. Finally, to Cameroon, where the UN has released $1.7 million from its emergency relief fund to help the authorities tackle a cholera epidemic. Announcing the move on Monday, the Office of the Emergency Relief Coordinator, Martin Griffiths, noted that the assistance will be targeted in the southwest and coastal regions in the form of case management, water hygiene and sanitation to affected communities. Latest data from the Cameroonian Health Authority indicates that more than 8,200 cases of cholera and 154 deaths have been registered. 7 regions have been affected by the epidemic. UN Children's Fund UNICEF and the World Health Organization WHO are tasked with rolling out the support, working with local authorities and non-governmental organizations. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
The National Weather Service reported the Springfield Twister was the biggest storm to pass through central Illinois in a decade.
The West Texas wildfires have scorched so much land that it's like watching more than half of Rhode Island burn.
Biggest one I've ever seen.
I love to drive. You could say I'm an autoholic. My life began in a car, so Dad tells me. I discovered sex in the back seat too. I made my own kid there. I may die out on the road. When things get boring, I drive around looking for something else. And if it's no good here, I go there. Too hot? We'll just go north into the hills. Too cold? Off south, just like the birds. Sometimes, I don't even know why I'm going. I'm just out there on the road, rambling around. I've just got to get out there and drive, maybe for a day or two, and see some country, some trees. I need to see nature. I've worked in vehicles and slept in them, even lived in one. Can't count all the hours I've just waited somewhere with the motor running, for red light, for traffic to move, for somebody to come out, for anything. Who even hears the motor running there under your thoughts? Vibration is good, moves the blood around. We don't even smell these engines unless something's broken. I've driven them all. Motorcycles, three-wheelers, minis, SUVs, compacts, pickups, a limousine, a truck, tractors, golf carts, you name it. If it's got a motor, that's good for me. And the power, the roar, the jolt of energy, the thrill of speed. I've got this armored steel that can run away, or run over, or damn near fly. My ride talks for me, tells you who I am. Without it, I'd just be a naked little animal out there in the rain and snow, like a snail without a shell. Likely I wouldn't kill for fuel, but my taxes pay for soldiers who will, by God. Gotta have gas. And if by accident I had to run over some kid, heaven forbid, or some old fart, I may lose my license for a little while, but I'll keep driving. We all need to get around. Okay, the weather is getting really weird. You never know what might happen. If this place floods or burns, I'll toss my stuff in here and go somewhere better. I'm not walking around like a loser. Notice anybody else getting off the road? Not likely. On my dying day, when I go, it'll be sitting upright behind the wheel. Check out Radio EcoShock, the planet's only all-environment radio station at www.ecoshock.org.
And you can catch Radio EcoShock tomorrow on Radio Free Kansas. And now Counterspin with Jackson.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, some of the worst work that corporate news media do is to convince us that simple things are actually, if you just ignore the role of power, much more complicated than you could hope to understand. So, yes, COVID is killing millions of people, and yes, there are tests and treatments and vaccines for it. And yes, many countries are in need of those things. But no, we cannot put those things together for reasons that, well, you shouldn't worry your head over. There are, in fact, people and policies with names preventing developing countries from accessing life-saving vaccines and treatment. And a story being ugly doesn't mean that it isn't understandable. We'll talk about that with Lori Wallach, Executive Director of the group Rethink Trade. At the same time, we are to understand that insurance companies exist to protect us from exorbitant expenses when we're faced with healthcare crises. You might be mad paying in when you're healthy, but oh boy, just wait till you're sick. So COVID-19 could hardly be a bigger public healthcare crisis. So where are insurance companies? Shouldn't this be their shining hour? And if not, can we please revisit their purpose in our lives? We'll talk about insurance in a pandemic with physician and advocate Steffi Woolhandler. That's all coming up, and we're going to get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The World Health Organization announced that nearly 15 million people have died as a direct or indirect result of the COVID-19 pandemic. That's almost three times as many as officially reported. The information, the group said, doesn't just illustrate the devastating impact of the pandemic, but also, quote, the need for countries to invest in more resilient health systems that can sustain essential health services during crises, including strong health information systems, close quote. Well, surely that includes tests, treatments, and vaccines. And there's a role there for journalism in appropriately reporting the importance and the availability of these public health tools. In particular, there are COVID vaccines that seem to be effective, yet vast portions of the global population remain unvaccinated. What is standing in the way, put simply? Our next guest has been working on that question. Lori Wallach has been decoding trade policy for decades. She's now executive director at Rethink Trade. She joins us by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Lori Wallach.
Thank you very much.
Well, we hear night and noon about markets, about supply and demand. If there's a need, suppliers will rush to fill it, and everybody's going to be satisfied. Well, there could hardly be a more obvious need than the need for COVID vaccines. So if you were trying to break down for people why so many people, in particular in the global south, are still not vaccinated, what's the deal? How do we explain it?
Well, the market does not work in the face of monopolies. And in the case of these medicines, a handful of now billionaire pharmaceutical companies have monopoly control over these life-saving medicines. So, for instance, we know by far the most effective vaccines are the mRNA vaccines, including the one developed using U.S. government money by Moderna. And we know now there are new Moderna billionaires created by the profits of selling that. And Moderna has simply refused to license the information to have more production around the world so a greater volume of that vaccine could be produced. And part of the obstacle is Big Pharma got inserted into so-called free trade agreements, binding obligations on countries to maintain and enforce these monopolies, which are government-created monopoly licenses called patents, and other forms of intellectual property monopoly that literally have made it possible for a few very big companies to control supplies, control production, and have a situation where today less than 20% of people in developing countries are vaccinated.
I don't want to overuse the word perverse, but it's hard to see past it in this case. Even folks who believe that, you know, if you build a better mousetrap, you ought to get the profit from that, can see that this is not a system working in a way that it should for the public good. So I guess I'm asking, what has been the pushback against this? Clearly, folks are aware that this protection of patents is slowing down and harming human life around the globe. And what have been the efforts to push back against it?
I will discuss that, but I wanted to say one thing, which is the issue at stake isn't taking away someone's creation or invention.
Right.
It's taking away the ability to control how much of it's being made.
Yes.
So these companies would get paid. They would get a licensing fee. They just wouldn't be able to make it such that they can reduce supply and drive up prices. Or in this instance, they don't want to share the technological innovation of the mRNA platform because they figure the next drug they can also monopolize. So if the many companies around the global south that could be making these wonder drugs learn how to do it, the companies like Pfizer and Moderna theorize, then the next drug, if it's for cancer, if it's what forever, they won't be able to control. It is diabolical. And so in the face of that, there's been a huge push in numerous countries to do three things. One, to get a temporary emergency waiver of the rules in the World Trade Organization that require every WTO signatory country to enforce those corporate pharma monopolies. Number two, to have government technology transfer. The U.S. government has authority under statutes like the Defense Production Act, particularly with respect to the Moderna vaccine, which the U.S. 100% paid for to have developed and then paid for all the doses of. The Moderna vaccine, the access to the information the government could require as a matter of national emergency, be licensed. They could make them do it. even if the WTO waiver weren't done for worldwide access. And then number three is sufficient funding so that though it is no substitute for countries being able to make their own, enough doses could be bought and shared around the world. And currently, on all three fronts, there's been total failure. And this very weekend, the WTO's fight is coming to a head about whether or not the European Union, the United Kingdom, and Switzerland will block the entire rest of the world, block it on behalf of Big Pharma. The U.S. has taken a fairly constructive position in this, and yet it could be blocked such that we go forward into another year of pandemic with a situation that means not just are people going to die needlessly and have their livelihoods destroyed, but new variants are going to spring up. Any place around the world there is rampant outbreak of COVID is the place where a new variant that could come back to get people who are vaccinated for the current variant. It's short-sighted in every front, to say nothing of immoral.
Is there a fallacy at the heart of this? Can we ever retire the notion that if manufacturers don't get exclusive intellectual property rights, that they will never be incentivized to do anything? You've already indicated that this is, in fact, public spending that has gone into the creation of some of these things. But I still feel when you read media coverage, you get the idea that, you know, if we don't incentivize these companies, they won't do the research. And I just feel that's like a hardy perennial fallacy that we see again and again in media in terms of medical research and things like this.
Well, you know, the choice isn't between no return on investment or price gouging and killing people.
Mm-hmm.
There is a happy medium where, of course, people who've made genius inventions should be rewarded for their creativity and hard work. But having, for instance, the ability in the face of a pandemic to simply control medicines that mean people will live or people will die. The global economy will or will not collapse. This is an emergency circumstance for which there was to be an emergency waiver. Again, the companies were going to get paid.
Right.
So it wasn't whether or not they would lose all control of their invention. But once the rich countries that could pay had paid, could people in the poor countries who were never going to pay the same amount per dose because their governments couldn't afford it, could they have access at a lower price? Could they have access because there'd be a larger volume at any price? In most of the developing world, it has been entirely impossible to get the cutting-edge mRNA vaccines that are most effective. And right now, with Paxlovid, the treatment that is the difference between COVID being a death sentence and COVID being something that will make you uncomfortable if you're a high-risk person or if you're someone who hasn't been vaccinated, Pfizer is only licensing production of that medicine in the poorest countries. So if you're in a middle-income country, you simply can't get it. It's simply not available. That is not a matter of reward or not reward.
Yeah.
That is extreme greed, where you could have a reward and have people live. And that is why we need to replace our current IP system to have it more balanced so that innovation is rewarded, but medicine is available at prices that people, particularly in developing countries, can pay.
Well, let me just ask you finally, if you are talking to journalists about who, you know, they're going to cover the story, the issue, but are there avenues and questions they might ask that they've not been doing that might shine a more helpful light on this?
I think there's been a lot of spin about what's gone on. Here's the reality. At the World Trade Organization in October 2020, South Africa and India proposed an emergency short-term waiver of all the intellectual property provisions necessary to be able to make these mRNA vaccines. And it's not just patents. It's certain technology transfer of undisclosed information. It's certain copyright provisions. It's certain what's called industrial design exclusivities. And it was for the duration, short-term, of the pandemic. And it would have made an enormous difference in who would have lived and who would have died. And here we are almost 2 years later, and this emergency waiver mechanism has not been usable. And the press has not really covered the whys about this. And in fact, they keep reporting things that aren't the case. For instance, right now, the WTO has shifted from focusing on saving lives to saving its reputation. The director general of the WTO has put forward a rump tax supported only by the European Union, i.e. the key blocker of the actual needed removal of the IP barriers, and is trying to railroad that into approval to announce the WTO's relevance, and is locking countries, big developing countries that have been having a role in this debate for 2 years, locking them in the hall, literally won't let them in the negotiating room.
Wow.
Is spinning up a storm of how we've come to a compromise. In fact, the text that's now being discussed explicitly is not a waiver and does not get any of the IP barriers out of the way and wouldn't put a single more vaccine into access in the developing world. And a lot of reporters keep calling it a waiver when there isn't one, keep calling it a compromise when there isn't one, keep pretending that negotiations on the WTO's IP barriers getting out of the way are still ongoing when they're not. And they're not really holding accountable the pharmaceutical corporations, the European Union, or the WTO staff. Plus, the U.S. has basically in the last 6 months not played a great hand in that the U.S. position has been any WTO deal can only be about vaccines, not about the treatment. And so the treatments, basically, under any circumstance, under the U.S. view, being excluded from this potential ability to make more volume, mean that the U.S. strategy, which is treat and test, test and treat, would not be available for most of the world. And it's just something that didn't have to be. So what we see happening around the world is countries basically ready to escalate and civil society activists as well. If you can't use the legal procedures, then it's time for direct action. Ideally going around all of these limits, but if necessary, to just ignore them. Basically direct action to get the meds made and let the lawsuits fall later.
All right, then. Well, we're going to pick this up again in the future, but we'll end it here for now. We've been speaking with Lori Wallach. She's Executive Director of Rethink Trade online at rethinktrade.org. Lori Wallach, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
We don't generally do media criticism by counterfactual, but it seems fair to ask, given that we are told that insurance companies protect us, you pay into them for a reason, and that it's about things happening to you that you don't have control over. So how are insurers responding to a genuinely public health crisis like COVID-19? You don't have to be poor or black or an immigrant to be affected by this. So it should be a genuine test. Joining us now with an assessment is Steffi Woolhandler. She's a physician and professor at City University of New York and co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program. She joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Steffi Woolhandler.
My pleasure.
Well, like I say, we don't generally talk about what media don't do, but I have not seen really any coverage about the way that insurers are responding to a public health crisis. So I guess I would ask you, what would insurers have done ideally, but then what's actually happening?
Well, the major insurers saw 2020 as a giant opportunity for profiteering. And what had happened is they had been receiving a little more than half of their total revenues from the government, either the federal government through the Medicare program or combined federal and state through the Medicaid program. So our so-called private insurers were already largely publicly funded. When the pandemic hit, believe it or not, the total cost of delivering health care fell dramatically. And that's because so many people were afraid to go get elective surgery, afraid to see their doctors, so that the revenues of hospitals and doctor's offices plummeted. The payments to doctors and hospitals plummeted. Even as some hospitals were, you know, swimming in COVID patients, they still saw their total revenues for all disease categories go way down. Now, the insurance industry, meanwhile, had already collected the premiums from the government and they never bothered to give any of it back, and apparently the federal and state governments never demanded any of it back, because by the end of the year, the largest insurers had seen huge jumps in their insurance overhead. That's the money they received as premiums and never paid out to doctors and hospitals. Massive increases in what is known as insurance overhead. And, you know, they put virtually all of that into their pockets as profits. You know, you can hide some of it by expanding or something called intercorporate transfers, where they mush the money around within their own corporation between subsidiaries. But by and large, they just pocketed this money as high overhead. And the thing that's interesting from a media criticism point of view is that this was right there in plain sight when the official government figures for health spending were released in December. The official government figures showed huge increases in private insurance company overhead, and they showed that most of those increases came from the overhead they were getting from the federal and state government. So what ended up happening is they just got a whole lot richer, and they turned around and have used that for high profits, for expansion, to take over more of the public Medicare and Medicaid programs. And there was essentially no coverage of it. What happened when the government figures came out in December was much of the media covered the other finding, which was quite expected, which was government public health expenditures jumped in 2020. Of course they did. That was what was supposed to happen. But the media failed to cover the figures that were there in plain sight showing a massive increase in insurance companies' overhead and profits.
I feel like a dummy in looking at this, because we're in a moment where we are supposedly really seriously looking at healthcare, you know, and health expenses in this country. And so I feel genuinely confused about why we have a system or continue to have a system that would do that, you know, where we would be facing a genuine public health crisis and we would be seeing profiteering from the very people who we're told, you know, yes, you pay when you're healthy, and that seems bad. But when you're sick, that's when you'll be really grateful for it. And that seems like the opposite of what's happening here.
Well, when you go into a public health system, a public health insurance system, that is kind of what happens. So before Medicare was privatized by the Medicare Advantage industry, you know, we were all paying a lot of money into Medicare out of our payroll taxes. Once you turned 65, you paid a premium. But then if you got sick, essentially all of that money was paid out to take care of sick people. You know, 98% of all the money that goes into traditional Medicare comes out as payments to doctors or hospitals or drug companies. Only 2% ever went for Medicare's overhead, you know, pushing the papers around and keeping track of people. But you have to look at the Medicare Advantage industry, which is taking over traditional Medicare, where year upon year, they report overhead of 15%. So 15% of the total cost is being scraped off the top for the overhead and profits of Medicare Advantage industry. And in 2020, they got an extra opportunity to make even larger profits. So the year before the pandemic, their overhead was about $1,800 per Medicare enrollee. I mean, already a huge amount of money. That $1,800 for every Medicare Advantage enrollee is just going for insurance overhead.
Right.
Outrageous. But during the pandemic, that overhead soared and was more than $2,200 per enrollee in 2020. And what should have happened is that government should have said, wait, we paid for this. We're clawing it right back, you know, using it for medical care or returning it to the taxpayers. But in fact, it was ignored, this giant leap in overhead. And just recently, the Biden administration announced that he was going to actually increase the payments to the private Medicare Advantage industry. He gave them an 8.5% increase this year. So, you know, there's lots of talk about, oh, what are we going to do about cost? What are we going to do about inflation? But no one is talking very much about what are we going to do with the private insurance industry taking over Medicare and Medicaid and inflating the cost of care in those programs, which is exactly what we saw in 2020, which is right there in the National Health Expenditure Accounts, the numbers the government released. And no one wants to talk about it because the private health insurance industry has this formidable lobbying force in every state and every congressional district, and they're just getting their message across to Congress and the government, you know, don't interfere with our profit making.
And, you know, private insurers also play a big role in board membership in media organizations, which is a thing that FAIR has looked at. But it's a very kind of silent or stealthy influence because it's not made explicit. It's just kind of guardrails. We can't do this. You know, it might make sense. Oh, no. Somehow, for some reason, we can't take this common sense response or this public health response to what's going on. It's weird.
It's weird. It's a public health response. And it's also, you know, if we're going to fight costs and inflation, we have to look for unnecessary costs. And there it is sitting there, huge overhead and profits in these private insurance industries. They're private in name only, since at this point more than half of their funding is coming straight out of the taxpayers. We ought to be looking at that and saying, no, we cannot afford to waste 15% or more on private insurance industry overhead when the fully public traditional Medicare program could do the same job for 2% overhead.
Absolutely. Well, Steffi, we use you as an object lesson at FAIR. You might not know this, but years ago, there was a conversation on what was then called the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour, I guess, PBS NewsHour, in which we were talking about public health care and single payer and a response to public health care needs. And you were one of four participants on a panel talking about actually publicly funding health care. And the host, which I'm guessing was Jim Lehrer, said, well, you know, Ms. Wohlhandler, you're in the minority here with your trying to argue for single payer or something like that. And you, because you had the presence of mind to do it, said, well, I'm only in the minority here because of the panel that you have selected, you know. And in fact, and this is what I'm bringing it round to, in fact, the U.S. public has in mind, has this frustration that we're talking about, has an understanding that there is a better way to do this. And media, it's not just what they hide, but they don't actually fairly represent public opinion in terms of what the U.S. public is interested in and needs in terms of health care.
I think that's true. I think the majority of American people hate the private health insurance industry, recognize that their business model is to get as much money from you as they can in premiums and pay out as little as they possibly can in health care. That's not going to be surprising to listeners that that's the business model of private health insurance. Polls are still showing more than 60% of Americans support a single-payer Medicare for all. And certainly there are bills in Congress. The Sanders bill in the Senate was just reintroduced. The Jayapal bill in the House was just reintroduced. But the media coverage of it, the discussion of anger at private insurance companies, of the profiteering by private insurance companies, is really very minimal. And I do think media can be doing a better job when data comes out, as came out in December, showing the extent of profiteering the private insurance industry, covering that information and not what in fact happened, where the only thing what was said, oh, look, healthcare costs went up 10%. It's all because of public health spending. That's not true. There was public health spending, and then there was insurance industry profiteering that caused health costs to go up so fast.
All right. Well, we've been speaking with Steffi Wohlhandler, physician, professor at CUNY, and co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program. Thank you so much, Steffi Wohlhandler, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Well, there you have it. And now we're going to go into the latest headline, world headline news from Democracy Now! Provided this morning, and go right after that, some of the clips that they played of yesterday's January 6th committee hearing, and it'll bleed over into John Grant, Ivan, maybe we can get some commentary out of him about it. It'll be interesting what he has to say. Here's the headlines from Democracy Now! Today.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection held its second public hearing Monday. Video testimony was aired of numerous Trump White House insiders saying there was no basis to Donald Trump's claims the election was stolen. Former Attorney General William Barr said Trump was, quote, detached from reality for refusing to accept his election loss. The committee also revealed Trump heavily relied on far-fetched claims by his lawyer, Rudolph Giuliani, who was reportedly drunk on election night when he pushed Trump to falsely claim victory. The House panel also examined how Trump's campaign raked in over $250 million in donations from his supporters after the election for an election defense fund that did not exist. This is committee member, Congressmember Zoe Lofgren.
Throughout the committee's investigation, we found evidence that the Trump campaign and its surrogates misled donors as to where their funds would go and what they would be used for. So not only was there the big lie, there was the big ripoff.
We'll spend the rest of the show after headlines on the January 6th hearing, and Democracy Now! Is live streaming all these hearings live at democracynow.org. The next one is Wednesday morning at 10 Eastern. It's primary day in Maine, Nevada, North Dakota, and South Carolina. In Nevada, Republican voters will be deciding who will challenge Democratic Senator Catherine Cortez Masto in November, in a race that could decide who controls the Senate. The Republican Senate race pits former Nevada Attorney General Adam Laxalt against retired Army Captain Sam Brown. Laxalt's a close ally of Donald Trump, who supported Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election. A number of other Republicans who supported Trump's coup attempt are also on the ballot today. The lives of 338,000 people who died of COVID-19 could have been saved if the United States had a universal health care system. That's the finding of a new study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences USA. The study also estimates a universal health care system would have saved the United States $459 billion in health care costs in the year 2020. The study's lead author, Allison Galvani of the Yale School of Public Health, told Scientific American, quote, "Medicare for all would be both an economic stimulus and life-saving transformation of our health care system. It'll cost people far less than the status quo," she said. In other health news, a new study funded by the National Institutes of Health has concluded ivermectin is not effective at treating COVID-19. The study was conducted by researchers at Duke and Vanderbilt universities. The United Kingdom's expected to begin flying asylum seekers to Rwanda today as part of a new immigration policy widely decried by religious leaders and human rights groups. The UK plans to send asylum seekers to Rwanda who have crossed the English Channel into Britain, regardless of where they came from originally. Leaders in the Church of England have condemned what they describe as a, quote, immoral policy that shames Britain. On Monday, Filippo Grandi, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, also criticized the plan.
The precedent that this creates is catastrophic for a concept that needs to be shared, like asylum. We believe that this is all wrong. This is all wrong, this deal, for so many different reasons. And I can enumerate a few.
In eastern Ukraine, Russian forces have destroyed the last bridge connecting Severodonetsk to other areas under Ukrainian control as heavy fighting continues in the city. Ukraine's calling on Western nations to provide far more in heavy arms. On Monday, Ukraine requested 300 rocket launchers, 500 tanks, and 1,000 howitzers. This comes as Russia's begun issuing passports in some areas it's occupying in eastern Ukraine as Russia attempts to solidify its rule in the region. Meanwhile, Russia's accusing Ukraine of firing NATO-supplied artillery on a market in a Russia-controlled area of Donetsk, killing three people, including a child. Authorities in India have demolished the homes of several Muslim activists who organized protests last week, triggered by recent anti-Islamic comments made by two members of Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist BJP party. The demolitions took place in the northern Indian state of Uttar Pradesh. Police also shot dead two teenage Muslim protesters. Hundreds of Muslims have been arrested. The Indian journalist Rana Ayub tweeted on Monday, quote, "The Modi government's never sent a more chilling message to its Muslim minority. Speak up, protest, and you will be jailed, booked for terrorism, your houses demolished, shot in public with no semblance of law and judiciary," she said. A number of Muslim countries have also launched protests over India's treatment of its Muslim population and recent statements by Hindu officials insulting the Prophet Muhammad. Iran suspects Israel is responsible for poisoning two Iranian scientists who recently died within days of each other in separate cities after apparent food poisoning. The New York Times reports one of the scientists worked at an Iranian military research center. The other was a geologist who, according to some press accounts, may have worked at Iran's Natanz nuclear facility. Israel is also believed to be behind last month's drone attack on an Iranian military site that killed a young Iranian engineer who worked for Iran's Ministry of Defense. Over 100 million people are under heat advisories in the United States as an early season heat wave continues to break records from the Southwest to the Gulf Coast to the Great Lakes. Over the weekend, temperatures in Phoenix, Arizona reached 114 degrees Fahrenheit and 109 degrees in Las Vegas, Nevada. In Houston, local officials warned residents to stay inside.
When you have extreme heat, then everyone is a danger. When you suffer heat exhaustion, or heat stroke, then your vital organs, your brain suffers damages, and you could die.
This comes as wildfires have forced hundreds of people to evacuate their homes in California, New Mexico, and Arizona. According to National Interagency Fire Center, firefighters are battling more than three dozen uncontained fires. In Montana, record flooding has forced the closing of all five entrances to Yellowstone National Park. Roads and bridges in the area have been washed away. Some visitors are stranded in the park following unprecedented rainfall. Flood levels on the Yellowstone River are now beyond record levels. In some areas, as the river is 2 feet higher than previous records. Scientists have long warned the climate emergency will lead to an increase in the number and severity of heat waves, wildfires, and storms. In related news, the Nobel Peace Prize laureate Malala Yousafzai joined with youth climate activists Greta Thunberg and Vanessa Nakate on Friday in a protest outside the Swedish parliament. Yousafzai talked about how the climate emergency is impacting girls across the globe.
Due to climate-related events, millions of girls lose their access to schools. Events like droughts and floods impact schools directly. Displacements are caused due to some of these events. And because of that, girls are impacted the most. They're the first ones to drop out of schools and then the last ones to return as well.
In Ohio, Republican Governor Mike DeWine has signed a bill to make it easier for teachers and staff to carry guns in school. Under the new law, teachers and staff will need just 24 hours of training, down from 700 hours. Teacher unions and the Fraternal Order of Police of Ohio have opposed the new law. The U.S. Supreme Court issued two rulings on Monday, which will make it much harder for people in immigration custody to challenge their detention. In one case, the court ruled non-citizens who've been held for more than 6 months in immigration custody are not entitled to bond hearings. Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote the majority opinion. In a second related case, the court ruled jailed immigrants cannot come together to file class action lawsuits to demand periodic bond hearings. But in this case, Sotomayor wrote a partial dissent, noting, quote, today's holding risks depriving many vulnerable non-citizens of any meaningful opportunity to protect their rights. Police officers in Idaho have reportedly received death threats after arresting 31 members of the white supremacist organization known as the Patriot Front, who are accused of plotting to start a riot at a gay pride event in the city of Coeur d'Alene. The white supremacists were found packed into the back of a U-Haul truck armed with riot gear, including a smoke grenade and shields. On Monday, the Patriot Front members were released on bail, which was set at $300 per person. A group of more than 300 doctors from around the world are calling on UK Home Secretary Priti Patel to block the extradition of Julian Assange. In a letter to Patel, the group known as Doctors for Assange say the WikiLeaks founder suffered a mini stroke last October and that his overall health is continuing to deteriorate in prison. The doctors write, quote, the extradition of a person with such compromised health, moreover, is medically and ethically unacceptable, they said. Patel is expected to rule on Assange extradition by Friday. And there are conflicting reports out of Brazil about the search for the missing British journalist Dom Phillips and the Brazilian indigenous expert Bruno Araújo Pereira. The pair went missing over a week ago in one of Brazil's most remote areas of the Amazon. On Monday, the family of Phillips said they were notified by the Brazilian embassy in London that two bodies tied to a tree were found during the search operation. However, the federal police in Brazil and indigenous activists aiding the search have said no bodies have been found. The search is focused on a remote area where authorities found personal items belonging to the two men on Saturday. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Monday, the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol held its second public hearing, with two more scheduled this week, Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern and Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Democracy Now! Is bringing you the hearings live at democracynow.org. The Washington Post reports there will likely be eight hearings this month, with a possible final hearing in September just ahead of November's midterm elections. Monday's hearing was briefly delayed when one of the witnesses, former Trump campaign manager Bill Stepien, pulled out of testifying live when his wife went into labor. In addition to becoming a father, Stepien is also currently serving as an advisor to the Trump-endorsed congressional candidate running against the committee's Republican vice chair, Liz Cheney, in Wyoming. Video testimony was aired Monday of numerous Trump White House insiders saying there was no basis to Donald Trump's claims the election was stolen. The committee also laid out how Trump used lies about election fraud to raise $250 million from his supporters for an election defense fund that did not exist. This is part of committee vice chair Liz Cheney's opening remarks.
First, you will hear firsthand testimony that the president's campaign advisors urged him to await the counting of votes and not to declare victory on election night. The president understood even before the election that many more Biden voters had voted by mail because President Trump ignored the advice of his campaign experts and told his supporters only to vote in person. Donald Trump knew before the election that the counting of those mail-in ballots in several states would not begin until late in the day and would not be complete for multiple days. This was expected, reported, and widely known. You will also hear testimony that President Trump rejected the advice of his campaign experts on election night and instead followed the course recommended by an apparently inebriated Rudy Giuliani to just claim he won and insist that the vote counting stop, to falsely claim everything was fraudulent. He falsely told the American people that the election was not legitimate. In his words, quote, a major fraud. Millions of Americans believed him. Second, pay attention to what Donald Trump and his legal team said repeatedly about Dominion voting machines. Far-flung conspiracies with a deceased Venezuelan communist allegedly pulling the strings. This was, quote, complete nonsense, as Bill Barr said. President Trump's own campaign advisors, his Department of Justice, and his cybersecurity experts all told him the same thing. Here, for example, is White House lawyer Eric Hirschman. His view was shared by many of the Trump team whom we interviewed.
I thought the Dominion stuff was, I never saw any evidence whatsoever to sustain those allegations.
And third, as Mike Pence's staff started to get a sense for what Donald Trump had planned for January 6th, they called the campaign experts to give them a briefing on election fraud and all the other election claims. On January 2nd, the general counsel of the Trump campaign, Matthew Morgan, this is the campaign's chief lawyer, summarized what the campaign had concluded weeks earlier, that none of the arguments about fraud or anything else could actually change the outcome of the election.
Generally discussed on that topic was whether the fraud, maladministration, abuse, or irregularities, if aggregated and read most favorably to the campaign, would that be outcome determinant? And I think everyone's assessment in the room, at least amongst the staff, Mark Short, myself, and Greg Jacob, was that it was not sufficient to be outcome determinant.
As is obvious, this was before the attack on the Capitol. The Trump campaign legal team knew there was no legitimate argument, fraud, irregularities, or anything to overturn the election. And yet President Trump went ahead with his plans for January 6th anyway.
That's January 6th committee vice chair, Republican Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney. During Monday's hearing, the committee featured video testimony from the depositions of some of former President Trump's top campaign staff, including senior advisor Jason Miller, and Trump's own daughter, Ivanka Trump, who was his senior advisor, who all said Trump ignored them on election night in November 2020 when they argued against declaring victory. They described how Trump instead turned to his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, who they said was drunk when he urged Trump to claim he'd won and say the election was being stolen. This is former Trump campaign manager Bill Stepien in deposition testimony.
Do you remember Rudy Giuliani being at the White House on election night and into the early hours the next morning?
I do.
What do you remember about when he came?
I had heard that he was upstairs, you know, in that aforementioned reception area, and he was looking to talk to the president, and it was suggested instead that he come talk to several of us down off the map room.
You said that you had heard that Mr. Giuliani wanted to talk to the president, and then he was directed your way. Did you end up talking to Mr. Giuliani when he was directed your way?
I did.
What was that conversation?
A lot of conversations were directed my way. a few of us, myself, Jason Miller, Justin Clark, and Mark Meadows, gathered in a room off the map room to listen to whatever Rudy presumably wanted to say to the president.
Was there anyone in that conversation who, in your observation, had too much to drink?
Mayor Giuliani?
Tell me more about that. What was your observation about his potential intoxication during that discussion about what the president should say when he's addressed the nation on election night?
And the mayor was definitely intoxicated, but I do not know his level of intoxication when he spoke with the president, for example.
Were you part of any discussions with the people I mentioned, Mr. Stepien, Mr. Meadows, or anyone else, about whether the president should make any sort of speech on election night?
I spoke to the president. They may have been present, but president spoke to the president several times that night.
There are suggestions by, I believe it was Mayor Giuliani, to go and declare victory and say that we'd won it outright.
It was far too early to to be making any calls like that. Ballots were still being counted. Ballots were still going to be counted for days. And it was far too early to be making any proclamation like that.
I remember saying that, to the best of my memory, I was saying that we should not go and declare victory until we had a better sense of the numbers.
Okay. Can you be more specific about that conversation, in particular what Mayor Giuliani said, your response, and then anybody else in the room's response?
I think effectively Mayor Giuliani was saying, we want it. They're stealing it from us. Where'd all the votes come from? We need to go say that we won. And essentially that anyone who didn't agree with that position was being weak.
That's
what
Jason
was your
Miller.
View at the time as to what he should or shouldn't say?
I don't know that I had a firm view as to what he should say in that circumstance. The results were still being counted. It was becoming clear that the race would not be called on election night.
That was Ivanka Trump. This bill stepped
in. My recommendation was to say that votes were still being counted. It's too early to tell, too early to call the race. But, you know, we proud of the race we ran, and we, you know, think we're in good position, and we'll have more to say about this, you know, the next day, whenever we had something to say.
And did anybody who was a part of that conversation disagree with your message?
Yes.
Who is that?
The president disagreed with that. I don't recall the particular words. He thought I was wrong. He told me so. And, you know, that they were going to, you know, go in a different direction.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're bringing you highlights from Monday's hearing of the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, the second of eight hearings scheduled for this month. One of the key witnesses who testified live was former Fox News political editor Chris Steirwalt, who led the Fox News decision to become the first network to call Arizona for Joe Biden on election night, November 2020. Fox fired Steirwalt months later. Answering questions from California Congressmember Zoe Lofgren, Steirwalt said Trump's chance of winning was virtually zero. His comments were supported by Trump's former Attorney General, William Barr.
Mr. Steirwalt, I'd like you to explain a term that was thrown around a lot during the election, and that's the so-called red mirage. What does that mean?
So in the 40 or 50 years, let's say, that Americans have increasingly chosen to vote by mail or early or absentee, Democrats prefer that method of voting more than Republicans do. So basically, in every election, Republicans win election day and Democrats win the early vote. And then you wait and start counting. And it depends on which ones you count first, but usually it's election day votes that get counted first. And you see the Republicans shoot ahead, and then the process of bailing and binding and unbinding all those mail-in votes. And some states like Pennsylvania refuse to count the votes first, so you have to wait for all of that to come in. So in every election, certainly a national election, you expect to see the Republican with a lead, but it's not really a lead. When you put together a jigsaw puzzle, it doesn't matter which piece you put in first. It ends up with the same image. So for us, who cares? But that's because no candidate had ever tried to avail themselves of this quirk in the election counting system. We had gone to pains, and I'm proud of the pains we went to make sure that we were informing viewers that this was going to happen, because the Trump campaign and the president had made it clear that they were going to try to exploit this anomaly, and we knew it was going to be bigger because the percentage of early votes was higher, right? We went from about 45% of the votes being early and absentee to, because of the pandemic, that increased by about 50%. So we knew it would be longer. We knew it would be more. So we wanted to keep telling viewers, hey, look, the number that you see here is sort of irrelevant because it's only a small percentage of these votes.
So this red mirage, that's really what you expected to happen on election night.
Happens every time.
Thank you, Mr. Steyerwald. Now, I'd like to play a clip of Attorney General Bill Barr, who also explains what was expected to happen on election night.
Right out of the box on election night, the president claimed that there was major fraud underway. I mean, this happened, as far as I could tell, before there was actually any potential looking at evidence. And it seemed to be based on the dynamic that that at the end of the evening, a lot of Democratic votes came in, which changed the vote counts in certain states. And that seemed to be the basis for this broad claim that there was major fraud. And I didn't think much of that because people had been talking for weeks and everyone understood for weeks that that was going to be what happened on election night.
Mr. Stepien obviously could not be with us today, and it's proper for him to be with his wife as they welcome their child. But he also had discussions with the president about the red mirage, that is, that it would be a long night and that early votes would favor him, but that lots more votes would be counted over the course of the night and the days after. So let's play clip one from our interview with Mr. Stepien.
I recounted back to that conversation with him, in which I said, just like I said in 2016 was going to be a long night, I told him in 2020 that it was going to be a process again, as you know, the early returns are going to be positive, and we're going to be watching the returns of ballots as they rolled in thereafter.
So is it fair to say you're trying to present what you thought would be a realistic picture of what might happen over the course of that night, being election night?
That night and the days that followed. Yeah, I always told the president the truth, and I think he expected that from me, and I told him it was going to be a process. It was going to be we're going to have to wait and see how this turned out. So I just like I did in 2016, I did the same thing in 2020.
So let's watch a short clip of President Trump speaking after he received that information from his campaign advisors.
We want all voting to stop. We don't want them to find any ballots at 4 o'clock in the morning and add them to the list.
So when former President Trump said that, it contradicted what his advisors had warned would happen. We all know that mail-in ballots played an important role in the 2020 election. However, President Trump continuously discouraged mail-in voting. Mr. Stepien was so concerned about the president's position on mail-in voting that in the summer of 2020, he met with President Trump, along with House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. Let's play clip four.
Meeting that was had, in particular, I invited Kevin McCarthy to join the meeting, he being of like mind on the issue with me, mm-hmm. In which we made our case for why we believed mail-in voting not to be a bad thing for his campaign. But the president's mind was made up, and he understands go to the well on a particular topic.
We've got Grant on, and He just now got his copy of the New York Times, evidently. I've delivered newspapers when I was a young man, and it's a touch-and-go goddamn thing when you're delivering.
Yeah.
And but John's got his paper, and I brought him up to speed on what we have been listening to in the first hour.
Okay.
John Grant, how are you doing? It's 100 degrees.
Hey.
97 degrees here in Kansas.
Well, I tell you, we have a lovely day. I don't know what it is, but it's like low 80s or something, high 70s. It's just very comfortable. It's going to heat up, I think. But I just bought some plants, some mint, and some rosemary, which I'm going to plant around the yard, so I got my work cut out for me later, my gardening. So, yeah, the weather's good here, and I'm sure that heat's going to come east from you guys. That's the way it'll go.
110 million people are now under a heat advisory in the United States.
Wow. Yeah.
John Grant, shit from Pennsylvania.
What? What?
You want to hear any happy notes about? By the way, I got a letter from John Fetterman.
Oh, you did.
A fundraising letter.
Oh,
it's really good.
Well, he's good.
Cool,
he sends fundraiser letters to anybody. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, sure, but I mean, it's a letter, and I'm very impressed. I hope he wins. I really do.
Yeah, I'm pushing for him. We're gonna eventually put a sign in our yard. You know, we got. You know, we signage our yards, and
right on. Well, I'm probably giving money, but I'm sure there are people around me who will. And
yeah,
we'll help pay for your sign. So,
but you know, he's going against Mehmet Oz, who was a bit of a whack job, but. Fetterman's a whack job in his own way. You know, he's like, he's like, 8 foot tall or something, and you know, he walks around in a hoodie and shorts, you know, and things like that.
6'8", married with a woman from Brazil, and in the true spirit of Abbie Hoffman,
mm-hmm.
Dick West Coast in 1968. His wife runs a free store in Bradford, where they come from.
Brazil, yeah.
You broke up a little bit there.
I was, yeah.
Yeah, you need to take the mic because my telephones are probably melting right now.
Right, I hear you.
So mm-hmm. we played a clip of. Rudy Drunk.
Oh, I mean, God.
Definitely now, the clip,
yeah.
Saying that the night of the election, and he wanted to speak to Trump and declare.
Right.
Donnie won. That's what he.
Right. Drunk well, Rudy you know, was. The poll count wasn't even in, and Drunk Giuliani, you know, beat his way to the White House and said, we have to declare victory right now. And, of course, that whole gang, Trump had been declaring up to that point before the election even took place that there was going to be fraud connected to mail-in ballots. And, in fact, he had even said publicly that he was encouraging Republicans not to vote with mail-in ballots. And his campaign manager and et cetera, other people said, well, you know, that is ridiculous because, and I think Mark Meadows said this, that that's absurd because you're going to cut your own throat because a lot of Republicans are going to be ready to vote with mail-in ballots. You know, if you insist that Republicans only go to the ballot box to vote, that you're going to lose votes. It didn't seem to bother him because he kept saying it. Because I think it seems that they're building this case that even before the election, he was counting on losing. He knew he was going to lose, or he was preparing to lose, and so that became his, you know, the structure of his thinking. So that everything was based on this idea that
we lost, but we have to pretend that we won because of all this so-called fraud connected to mail-in ballots. And, of course, the word was out. I remember at the time all the cable channels and all were saying, we won't know this election for a day or so, maybe 2 days, because mail-in ballots come in, you know, they have to be counted afterwards. I think there was a law that the Republicans said that you can't count absentee ballots ahead of time, mail-in ballots ahead of time. Now, why that is, I don't know, but that way it does hold off the final verdict until maybe 2 days later. So it gives them this time to suggest, oh, they're now fraudulently stacking the deck. Well, you know, and, you know, whereas really what Giuliani wanted was, say you won that first night immediately before all these other mail-in votes are counted, because they knew those mail-in votes were going to be Democratic in many, many cases. And so here you have a drunken Giuliani apparently beating his way into the White House, pushing his weight around to get in to tell Bush, or not Bush, whatever, Trump, that now is the time, election night, you have to declare victory and we'll fight it from here on out. And, you know, the rest is history. And they're, you know, detail by detail by detail by detail laying this stuff out. So you wonder if I don't think Trump is going to be able to sustain this and hold on to the idea of running in 2024. I think he's done. But that doesn't mean that Trumpism is done, you know. So we'll wait and see. You know, we get, you know, DeSantos coming in Florida to become the new Trump. But we'll see. What do you think?
Bill Barr, I don't know about, I mean, you know, he, I'll play something at the end of this that it's a good closing clip. I think people are wising up out here. I think a lot of people have voted for him. Well, was some people describe him as inept or, you know, not capable of doing it. Others describe him as, you know deeply misunderstood, around people who stabbed him in the back, you know, various things like that, you know.
Of course.
on the Republican base, so-called base here in Kansas, that, you know, they'll be hard put to figure out who to vote for on the federal level, but they're going to continue to validate their more reactionary base in the state and county level.
Right.
This will most likely continue for them, and the crazier they are, more they'll vote for him. I've talked to some who I thought were level-headed Republicans, and I think they still are.
Right.
They've I mean, 7-year-old men are not buying muskets. They're buying guns. Not one gun, but two guns per member of their household. I mean, they still are in mentality that they have no government. They will stop. I guess they'll make a better world for the billionaires. When I put it to them, the federal government, think you're going to make a better world for the or for your grandbabies. They can't answer that. You know, they don't. They in many respects. More of them are upset with the billionaires, but hey, I might win the lottery. You know, I really
right.
I don't know. The gasoline is now over $5 a year.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
And I think, and I consider Biden conspiracy and food. I mean, we found out last week, a nice guy, I know him, that our only grocery stores in the county, three in the county.
Of course.
He just sold them.
Oh.
All three to one guy, and is getting out of the business, and the food is already sky high in his stores.
Sure.
So, I mean, I think people, and it appeared in the newspaper this last week that he sold them. So I think it makes people very interested in the financial
conditions
in their homes. And go ahead.
The typical sort of prejudice for fear and short-term issues, like, of course, inflation is hitting us, but, you know, I dare say it's not purely Joe Biden's fault. You know, it's just the fates after the pandemic, you know, all the money they hosed out for people to support the pandemic, and, you know, the war in Ukraine now. All of this is going to lead to recession, or maybe a bear economy and inflation, it seems to me. So if you take a short-term, immediate, magical kind of correction of these problems, well, naturally it's political to blame the guy sitting in the hot seat right now and to declare you have the solution when you're out of power and, nobody can test what you're saying. So I don't know. It just, you wonder what's going to happen when the election really comes around and, the poll that counts, people get out and do it. Because it seems to me if we continue in this country, to think in short-term fixes, like, of course, everything corporate is on a quarterly sort of, keep the bottom line, the profits up for the quarters for the stockholders and all that. I mean, that's the time frame America works under, is the quarterly, let's do it now. Let's not think like, of course, the classic idea is from the Native Americans, who, of course, we slaughtered and displaced, and they used to think in terms of seven generations. In other words, you make a decision, a major social and cultural decision, and you make it thinking seven generations ahead of you, But that is just that kind of thinking is absolutely unheard of amongst Americans. It's everything has to be now, immediately. We have a problem. It's obviously the problem of the guy sitting in the White House, and he's a bum, and it's to me, it's a tragic flaw. This is America's tragic flaw. It can't get out of its own way, that because it, it can't think ahead enough. The long view, it just takes this immediate profit motive of, and of course, we have a lot of rhetoric and nothing is really ever done, so it's even worse than we might think. It's just that, we just yammer back and forth in these polarized arguments and nothing is done in the idea of repairing a broken culture, for the long haul, for the long fight, for the long future, I don't know. That's useless talk, I know, because
I don't think it is.
The nature of the problem. I mean, it's like nobody wants to hear this.
Think that people want to that people are learning, but it may be slower.
Yeah.
Before you see.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's sort of like it took a while for. Mm-hmm. Many people realize that. Take one example.
Mm-hmm.
For people to realize they never thought about, the number of unarmed youth or gun downs
Yeah.
I mean, that wasn't that thing didn't happen overnight.
Right, of course. Nothing happened overnight, right?
In Missouri, I think got people thinking about it, and then they started looking around communities.
Right.
There was a woman, a girl, actually, a young woman.
Mm-hmm.
Fiona was her name. And it is alleged, this is all alleged.
Right.
The Missouri Police Department last weekend, it's become a high visibility, I guess you would say, incident where she's a young black woman, and
don't worry about it.
That's Air Force One coming over my house, telephone mm-hmm. call. So, anyhow, Leona Hale, she was in a car that was alleged to have been hijacked with a male, and
right.
they pull the car over. The male and runs. Leona Hale, African-American woman, gets out and runs
mm-hmm.
and runs down the street waving waving a gun. Okay, now, that's what the police said. It
uh-huh.
was less than 24 hours this weekend.
Yeah.
It's hot in the old one. I mean,
right.
out they were mad. The said that she was pregnant, shot 5 times in the back. They
oh.
got her to the hospital. The community outraged. They help. They bail her. She gets out of the hospital, goes to jail. It's a
wow.
in the hospital. They bail her out before she's even in jail. The community is boiling. And Black Lives Matter movement in this area,
mm-hmm.
the police immediately, rather than stonewalling and refusing to release any body cam videos,
mm-hmm.
the video is quite clearly carrying a gun and then pointing back behind her at the cop.
Right.
Now, shooting her in the back with 5 times, made that was excessive force, but
she lived. It's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, and but the photograph itself diffused immediately the situation. About unarmed black youth being killed by the police. Not the whole issue. An incident. And it was a City Star newspaper, quite clear photograph of her holding a gun, pointing it back, as she's running at the pursuing police on the foot. And, I think, that's to the credit of the government. The cops wear bows now, or around police, and that the prosecution, most importantly, the prosecution released photographed immediately.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's an example of democracy. It may not be the
Absolutely.
Kind of democracy.
Yeah.
Huh?
Well, information, the full information. Exactly. I think a lot of the problems with cops is they don't divulge information. They come out to a situation and they overreact. They act rashly out of fear. They're scared shitless. And in this case, they deemed that the information was on their side and they revealed it. I mean, if a woman is fleeing from the cops and reaching over her shoulder, shooting at them, they have, I think, a legitimate motivation to shoot her, absolutely.
Well,
back or whatever.
As far as the news accounts, she didn't shoot at him, but but the point is that she had a gun and was pointed at him. The point for me is the Black Lives Matter movement and the many people got involved in this move. It began way back in Ferguson, Missouri, years ago.
Of course.
With Michael Brown.
Well, years ago, absolutely.
It has made the country, at least in the policies of many of the police force, about open transparency. another example of transparency in police is in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, the arrest this weekend of 31 Patriot Front,
right.
I call them fascists, fascist young people. They were all, none of them looked over 35.
Mm-hmm.
Were all arrested in a youth thing as they were obviously getting ready to parties. I said to one of my friends, I said, it looked like they were packed in like illegal immigrants in that U-Haul.
Uh-oh.
And they got busted from just a person who, an onlooker who, low, they were way to GBQ, a pride park.
Right. They were going to shoot up a gay bunch or something, I forget. Yeah.
Well, no guns are found, but they're obviously ready to
harass them. Yeah.
And Rudy Giuliani would call mortal combat.
Right. Well, I thought this was a positive story out of goddamn Idaho. You know, Idaho is considered the best haven for right wing militia nutcases. So this was good that and they were standing up for terrorism against or harassment against gays or whatnot. So I took that as a good story.
Well, that's what I'm trying to say. Is I'm saying the thing that's among people is even in God, Idaho, in an opinion, I can't help. I want to be optimistic and think that these hearings on January will help many true believers. You know, the Trump true believers into at least doubting and questioning where they got these ideas. And they might be wrong. You know.
I think that's the ultimate question, whether the hearings will get traction, you know, in light of how the Mueller report, 500-page Mueller report, was trashed and, finessed, I guess is the word, by Bill Barr to say there's no there there, when au contraire, the place, the book was, packed with evidence of crimes. But that Mueller had decided, I don't know, in his dotage maybe or something, that he wasn't supposed to make any conclusions. Well, they're obviously doing their utmost to avoid that situation. With the woman yesterday, I can't think of her name here, Zoe Lofgren, she had a talking point that she said over and over again. I heard it like three times, I think, that this, that what Trump was doing was a ripoff of, of campaign money and all this. So they're going out of their way to make conclusions, which Mueller didn't do, of what this is. She calls it uses words of one and two syllables, rip off. These are not legal terms. These are terms that everybody can understand. Con men and grifting. They were using the word grift. His grift, which is a word I love.
Right.
His grift was to raise $250 million, $250 million. That was supposed to go to support their efforts to show that the Democratic win was based on fraudulent electioneering or whatnot. But that none of that money went to that. It went to other things, including, personal things, I guess, and all that. And, it's clearly, whether it's illegal, it's clearly unethical and corrupt. And, so she flogged that seriously and, again, was in her unwavering conclusion was it was a ripoff, which I love to use.
Well, here, let's just hold on just a minute. You ripped off my closing, so I'm going to a little bit of it right now.
The January 6th hearing ended with closing statements from committee vice chair, Republican Liz Cheney, and Democrat Zoe Lofgren, describing how the Trump administration raised over $250 million off his supporters on the false claim the 2020 election results were fraudulent.
Now that we understand the litigation efforts by President Trump and his allies, I'd like to present additional actions taken by the Trump campaign during this time. President Trump continued to push the stolen election narrative, even though he and his allies knew that their litigation efforts, making the same claim, had failed. It's worth pointing out that litigation generally does not continue past the safe harbor date of December 14th. But the fact that this litigation went on, well, that decision makes more sense when you consider the Trump campaign's fundraising tactics. Because if the litigation had stopped on December 14th, there would have been no fight to defend the election and no clear path to continue to raise millions of dollars. Mr. Chairman, at this time, I'd ask for unanimous consent to include in the record a video presentation describing how President Trump used the lies he told to raise millions of dollars from the American people. These fundraising schemes were also part of the effort to disseminate the false claims of election fraud.
Without objection, so
my name is Amanda Wick, and I'm Senior Investigative Counsel with the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol. Between Election Day and January 6th, the Trump campaign sent millions of fundraising emails to Trump supporters, sometimes as many as 25 a day. The emails claimed the, quote, left-wing mob was undermining the election, implored supporters to, quote, step up to protect the integrity of the election, and encouraged them to, quote, fight back. But as the Select Committee has demonstrated, the Trump campaign knew these claims of voter fraud were false, yet they continued to barrage small-dollar donors with emails, encouraging them to donate to something called the Official Election Defense Fund. The Select Committee discovered no such fund existed.
I don't believe there is actually a fund called the Election Defense Fund.
Is it fair to say the Election Defense Fund was another, I think we called it a marketing tactic?
Yes.
And tell us about these funds as marketing tactics.
Just a topic matter where money could potentially go to be, how money could potentially be used.
The claims that the election was stolen were so successful, President Trump and his allies raised $250 million, nearly $100 million in the first week after the election. On November 9, 2020, President Trump created a separate entity called the Save America PAC. Most of the money raised went to this newly created PAC, not to election-related litigation. The Select Committee discovered that the Save America PAC made millions of dollars of contributions to pro-Trump organizations, including $1 million to Trump Chief of Staff Mark Meadows' charitable foundation, $1 million to the America First Policy Institute, a conservative organization which employs several former Trump administration officials, $204,857 to the Trump Hotel Collection, and over $5 million to Event Strategies, Inc., the company that ran President Trump's January 6th rally on the Ellipse.
All of us here today do not want to see our election victory stolen by emboldened radical left Democrats, which is what they're doing.
The evidence developed by the Select Committee highlights how the Trump campaign aggressively pushed false election claims to fundraise, telling supporters it would be used to fight voter fraud that did not exist. The emails continued through January 6th, even as President Trump spoke on the Ellipse. 30 minutes after the last fundraising email was sent, the Capitol was breached.
Every American is entitled and encouraged to participate in our electoral process. Political fundraising is part of that. Small dollar donors use scarce disposable income to support candidates and causes of their choosing to make their voices heard. And those donors deserve the truth about what those funds will be used for. Throughout the committee's investigation, we found evidence that the Trump campaign and its surrogates misled donors as to where their funds would go and what they would be used for. So not only was there the big lie, there was the big ripoff. Donors deserve to know where their funds are really going. They deserve better than what President Trump and his team did. Mr. Chairman, I yield back.
Without objection, the chair recognizes the gentlewoman from Wyoming, Ms. Cheney, for a closing statement.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I would like to thank all of our witnesses today, and I'd also like to, in particular, wish Mr. Stepien and his family all the best on the arrival of a new baby. Today's hearing, Mr. Chairman, was very narrowly focused. And in the coming days, you will see the committee move on to President Trump's broader planning for January 6th, including his plan to corrupt the Department of Justice and his detailed planning with lawyer John Eastman to pressure the vice president, state legislatures, state officials, and others to overturn the election. Let me leave you today with one clip to preview what you will see in one of our hearings to come. This is the testimony of White House lawyer Eric Hirschman. John Eastman called Mr. Hirschman the day after January 6th, and here is how that conversation went.
I said to him, "Are you out of your effing mind?" I said, I only want to hear two words coming out of your mouth for now on. Orderly transition.
That is some kind of stuff, man.
I mean, you know, they got the goods on the guy. You know, he's a grifter. I mean, he's a classic, you know, sociopathic grifter, you know. You know, it's not surprising that our politics, you know, veers towards that because, you know, they even mentioned that this is termed, in the words of, you know, of our culture of marketing, you know, that they're thinking about all this stuff and raising money on the big lie that the fraud that, you know, that Biden really lost and, you know, all of this. And then they're using all the classic marketing tactics to sell it. And so what's happening is that you're having these Trumpian elements, you know, following, you know, the Putins of the world, these autocrats who have the cover of democracy, but it's a democracy that essentially, you know, reduces to marketing and public relations. It's not really democracy. It's like, you know, it's like a Walt Disney version of history. You know, it's not real. It's, you know, it's that it's packaging, it's marketing. It's saying, well, all of this stuff, you know, we can correct, even though it didn't go like, you know, we wanted it to. We can sort of market it and, you know, bullshit our way into, you know, making people believe it, you know, as, you know, and so you get to the point of where Stalin famously said, you know, it all comes down to who counts the votes, you know. And so this is, you know, this is the struggle that this hearing is going through, whether it can break this really crazy lock on people's minds that Donald Trump and company have pulled off, you know, that truth and reason and all of that stuff means absolutely nothing, that what's really true is that we live in a magical universe, and its authority is what counts, whether it's from God on down or what it is. You know, it's not, you know, the Enlightenment has been turned off, you know, and we're in the Dark Ages again where, you know, we're it's all, as I say, magical thinking, you know, it's not reasoned argument and facts and all that kind of stuff. And, of course, this hearing is trying, I think, you know, to systematically, because we've been through the Mueller report, we know how that was trashed, to systematically show the American people that they have been bamboozled. You know, you may like what Donald Trump says. He may work right into your, you know, your prejudices and your beliefs and all this, your fears. But in the end, you know, this guy's all about himself and his people and his family, if you will. And in the end, you know, they'll screw you. I don't care who you are. You know, it's like the old, what is it, that minister, famous minister Bonhoeffer or whatever his name was, in the Nazi era, who said, you know, when they came for the Jews, when they came for the homosexuals, when they came for the leftists and the communists, I said nothing. But when they came for me, there was no one left to say anything. You know, and so you can see all this stuff playing out. And so I hope you're right that some of this will wear off on, especially people in Kansas, you know, that have locked their minds into this Trumpian "Make America Great Again" nonsense. That somehow Trump and his narcissistic grifting will somehow, you know, make America great again, which is preposterous in my view. But, so it's all on this hearing, and, you know, we'll see what happens. It's going to be interesting. And I guess the next one is, what, tomorrow morning?
Yeah, tomorrow. And yeah. For some reason, it's Wednesday and Thursday.
Right, okay.
So it's 2 days. But,
right.
I guess they're going to do another one in September. The eight of them,
mm-hmm.
We've had one, two. There'll be five. There'll be six more.
Okay.
Immediately in the next coming week or week, 2 weeks, mm-hmm. And then they're going to do
in September. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, good. As we get into the fall before the midterms, you know, I mean, they certainly. I mean, the Republicans and Fox News present this as a conspiracy. Somehow Democrats want to win their elections is a conspiracy. You know, like, wait a minute. You know, of course they want to win the election. It's like getting up in the morning and having breakfast is a conspiracy. You know, it's like...
It's a diabolical plot
that the Democrats are, the Democrats are about power. Oh, my God, raw power. Are you kidding me? I mean, what are you guys about? Come on, you know. I mean,
well, I hate to steal from another popular, highly viewed cultural thing recent, but, I mean, I think Republican Party as a whole did an Amber Heard and shit on the bed of of the government.
Wow.
And they
Amber
did,
Heard,
and,
poor Amber Heard.
I think you could call Donnie Trump. I mean, you know, they're on and he shit on the Republican time and brought.
No. Yeah. Wait a minute. Let me get this straight. That Ms. Heard shit on Johnny Depp's pillow or something, or what? I didn't hear that little tidbit of information.
Yeah, on his bed.
Oh my God, that's what dogs do. You know, I had a dog that was pissed off at me because I took him. A friend of mine had to move, and I took this big rambunctious dog into my apartment, and he'd get all pissed off that I left. And one day I came back and he literally took a dump in my bed. And you know, he was this dog. I like this dog, actually. This dog was sending a message. Same with Miss Heard.
I've done several shows with that intent on you sometimes with you.
I beg your pardon.
The true crime detective in me says that there was no DNA on that pile of doo-doo, and there's a possible, you know, there's as many friends as Amber Heard had. She may have hired somebody to shit on Johnny Depp's bed. There's no real proof. It's just now somebody shit on Johnny Depp's bed.
Johnny Depp.
But nevertheless, it is both Bird and Arbor.
Yeah. Well,
that could be a link there.
Well, while we're on this topic, it reminds me of this fellow I knew once. He was a bit of a sociopath, I think, but he was with a woman that he was getting tired of, I think, and she had a cat. Let's say the cat's name was Fluffy, okay, just for kicks.
Oh,
and he took you know, I'm considering an adult audience here. He took a dump at the cat box. You know, he did. And so there was this huge dump in the cat box. And so his girlfriend, who he was trying to get, you know, leave, comes back and says, "Oh, my God, poor Fluffy. We're going to have to take her to the vets."
Yes.
Anyway, I probably should not have mentioned that story.
Oh, that's okay. Call your friend and have him listen.
Yeah, right.
As a producer, I'll do John his numbers. That's all I care about. But
cat
seriously,
box humor, you know.
Cat box humor, pop culture. Sure, why not? It's just pop culture now. But I don't think that. I think this committee hearing is culture. It is real history. I got a tip. I deserve a hat tip for trying to get some of the I think we have the largest population of idiots in the world in this country.
That may be. Yeah.
And that goes partisan. I mean that on both sides.
Right. You have a good argument there, yeah.
I just think that this is one that will go down in the record books. I want to offer this. I want to hear your thoughts because this is important.
Okay.
Who had a baby, his wife, he pulled out of hearings yesterday because his wife was going into labor.
Septian, I guess.
And, Septian, I think is his name.
Yeah.
Now, he was a marketing manager, a big-time operative with the Trump campaign, and obviously a Republican Party, quote-unquote, insider, because now he is managing campaign against Liz Cheney, and that he's a deep Trumper, a Trumper. So, let me think of that. That's very interesting. That this guy who's a witness, I don't think the children of war criminals should be punished for the crimes of their parents. Okay.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think Liz should be punished for war crimes.
You don't think, you lost, her, you think what? Liz Cheney what?
Should not be punished for the war crimes of her father.
No, well, of course she shouldn't. Of course not.
But
absolutely,
she,
of course not.
Okay.
And I think Liz Cheney, deserves all these accolades of, a JFK profile in courage. To me, she exhibits the classic narrative profile arc of what Kennedy wrote about, John F. Kennedy wrote about in his book Profiles of Courage, about people in Congress who stood up despite, very possible losing power and things like that. So, you can't blame Liz Cheney for, her father. And, of course, her father was the one who introduced us to the, quote, dark side. In other words, here was this, bald sucker who was, a Machiavellian to the core, telling the American public that we're going to have to participate in evil to beat these ragheads over there in Iraq. Pardon my epithet here. That's Dick Cheney, and he's going to go down in history as an evil man, in my view. But that doesn't reflect on his daughter. His daughter, I think, understands power, and I think she has an eye. She's a lean and hungry look. She has an eye on the future, that the Republican Party has you know, eviscerated itself morally in many ways, you know, and actually followed her father into the, quote, dark side, if you will, you want to look at it that way, that she has, in a sense, gone against her father in a way, and I'm sure her father understands her power urges and all that and supports her 100%, because he's got a new heart and he just wants to live a couple more months and years, you know. So, yeah, Liz Cheney, a profile in courage, but I'd keep an eye on her, but as I say, she has a lean and hungry look. You know, I think that comes out of Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, you know, and people, you know, having that, you know, that she sees, a, you know, 2024, she could very easily be the nominee for president of the United States, and she could win. If she runs against Harris or something, you know, they go against Biden, and they, you know, they run with Harris. You'd have two women running for president. You know, I'm not a fan of Harris. I mean, I obviously would vote for her against Liz Cheney, but still, you know, I mean, Liz Cheney is, she's taken a long, I mean, it's a long, long pass, you know, the Hail Mary pass, if you will. And, you know, she may look out and win the game, but we'll have to wait and see. But that's what I've always thought she was up to. But it took a real backbone and a real political courage, profile and courage, for her to do this. And so that's what she's doing. So, yeah, I guess I agree with you. Yeah, you can't hold her father against her. Or you can't hold it against her that she's a Republican because, you know, she is exhibiting a profile in courage.
Well, for a woman who is decidedly anti-LGBT, she's anti-gay, anti-homosexual.
Well, even though her sister is married and gay, and her mother wrote gay pornography, lesbian pornography, we know that. These are
Wait, John.
What?
And lesbian novels. What? That's how you say that, John.
Lesbian novels. Lesbian romance novels. Okay. Well, listen. Okay, fair enough. You know, a Bodice Ripper with between women, you know, it's, I don't know.
Yeah. Right.
You know,
but I think
some dyke ripped her Bodice. Oh.
Yeah, but maybe Liz Cheney is just his position on who knows.
Well, I'm not saying I politically support Liz Cheney. All I'm saying is that I don't hold her father against her at this point, and I think she is a profile of her.
Yeah.
Well, so now, be it. You know, where it goes.
So be it. Okay. So be it. Now we're on our closing time. So far, now isn't the justice when he was with Trump? Was it the Department?
I'm sorry, you broke up a little bit. What was the question?
Would Bill Barr, Attorney General, would that make him a head of the Department of Justice?
Yes.
When he was
absolutely
okay.
Absolutely. Right.
Wait, here's an interesting thing. The day Bill Barr heard on the hearings yesterday, and he invoked the famous word bullshit.
Right.
When it came to fraud.
Right. Right.
Last night, after he left the hearings, now this is literally after he left the hearings, he appeared on Fox News. Now, I was going to play running out of time. This way. Bill Barr slips around. Now, what was he doing for when he was wasn't Bill Barr involved in that administration, the Bush administration?
He was Attorney General earlier under, I guess, what, Bush 1 maybe? Or I'm a little vague.
He's been around a long time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He was. Yeah, he's been Attorney General twice. Like Donald Rumsfeld was Secretary of Defense twice, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but Bill Barr gets on Fox News.
Right.
I couldn't believe it. The book is called One Damn Thing After Another.
Right.
Or,
good title, I think.
Yeah. But he's on there.
You're breaking up a little bit there. Okay.
He's reassuring. He's reassuring that the Fox News audience that Donnie will not be indicted.
Yeah, Donnie well, we'll wait and see. You know, he may be right. He may be right. And, of course, the fact that he was under deposition, under oath, of course, he put his hand on the Bible when he made that bullshit remark. That was under oath. Well, when he's on Fox News, he's not under oath. He's on cover my ass mode. And so he is, you know, then protecting his image amongst conservatives. So I wouldn't give Bill Barr any great marks for integrity. You know, I would give him, a bit of a cowardly award. You know, okay, you under oath, you basically told the truth, and you know that the president was laying out a lot of quote bullshit. Well, we all know that, so okay, thanks, Bill, for doing that. And then, of course, he goes to Fox News and, you know, blathers out a bunch of nonsense that I suppose will sort of balance his image amongst conservatives. I don't know. God knows what the man is thinking. But, you know, I don't think he comes across as any great stellar, you know, person doing service to America. You know, he was a hack doing service to this orange-haired sociopath. And then, of course, it got too disgusting for even him, morally disgusting for even him. And of course, under oath, he let us know that. But, you know, again, you know, not a profile in courage.
Right. 1 minute closing.
Okay.
1 minute.
Well, I'm gonna watch tomorrow morning. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. What was the name of? I know the name. It's the movie is called 1900.
Oh,
I can't remember.
One of my favorite movies, Bernardo Bertolucci. 1900, a 5-hour-long epic on the battle of the left and right in Italy from January 1st, 1900 to 1976 when the movie was made. 76 years. It's just brilliant. I've watched it 3 times. It's 5 hours long. Okay.
Well, I have good news for our listeners. If you are a of Amazon Prime, it is now playing. It's
good.
Featured and it's playing, so.
It's a great movie. I have a DVD of it, you know. And it has, of course, Robert De Niro and Gerard Depardieu are the two. Sterling Hayden is the chief peasant, and Burt Lancaster is the chief landowner on this estate, January 1st, 1900. And you hear two babies crying as dawn comes up. And one of them will be Gerard Depardieu, who's a peasant, and the other one will be Robert De Niro, who is the child of a landowner. And it's all about the struggles between these two men and these two forces. And Donald Sutherland is a Nazi that does some pretty atrocious things. It's really a fine movie. And, again, it's about the struggle between the left and the right throughout Italian history from 1900 to 1976.
Yeah, it's something about the description on Amazon Prime and on Netflix
mm-hmm.
as the rise of fascism. So it's very interesting.
Well, the rise of fascism is in there for sure. Yeah, yeah. And the movie, of course, Bertolucci's sympathies are with the left. He doesn't like fascists, so it's.
I don't know who does.
It's an excellent movie. I recommend it to everybody out there in Kansas to, you know, watch it over a couple of nights or just, you know, binge and watch the whole damn thing. It's just.
Well, it's a good. It's
good, a great movie.
Good weather to do it. John.
Okay. All right. Be well. We'll be right back.